I am Michael Itchen, and you're listening to the EdTech Podcast, Cannot Take Over.
Michael, so we were just speaking because obviously the last couple of days have been a bit frantic for you.
It's been quite a couple of days, a lot of waiting, a lot of preparing, and then a lot of unpreparing. Because fortunately for us, we didn't really receive much of anything besides a blustery day and an evening of staying in the home with family and friends. But we're safe and everything is good here in South Florida.
And that's because of Hurricane, it's Matthew,
Hurricane
isn't it?
Matthew, yes, yeah. Yes.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that you're all okay. And so, as I understand it, so you're computer science and EdTech lead learner at Pinecrest School in Florida?
That's correct.
And so can you tell us a little bit about that role and how long you've been doing that?
Certainly. This is my second year at Pinecrest. Last year I was lower school computer science and middle school computer science. So I taught grades pre-K through 8, computer science principles and concepts and applied computer science. This year, I've moved to the middle school where I'm teaching 6th and 8th grade, also doing the Lego robotics coaching for lower and middle school, and then assisting with our teachers and faculty and staff for needs that are ed tech.
Okay, so I guess in the UK that might be akin to something like a digital manager role, so sort of helping to review what the opportunities are and putting those on the table in terms of how they would assist not just in computing but cross-curricular?
Correct, absolutely. Pinecrest is absolutely at the forefront of curricular engagement with the technologies. So this is what we do. We work with our teachers' curriculum first. In other words, what unit are you working with? What concept are you giving them? And then work on ways to integrate the tech, or sometimes to not integrate the tech into their classroom.
Yeah, that's what I like. So I just had a quick peek at your Twitter handle. And so, you know, you're navigator for my students and faculty on their high-tech or low-tech journeys.
Right. So that's exactly it.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the actual school? So in terms of scale and just to get everyone thinking about what type of school it is as well.
Sure. Pinecrest is a private school here in South Florida. We have two campuses, one in Boca Raton, which is pre-K through 8. And then the campus where I teach at is pre-K through 12. In Fort Lauderdale.
Brilliant. Okay. And in terms of Cano as well, so just thinking about, I guess, these new tools coming along, what's your relationship with Cano and how have you used that particular kit to help deliver some of the lessons or the learnings that you want to achieve?
I think I was one of the initial backers. Not initial, but when they first went out, I got myself a kit and it was just completely like nothing I've ever seen before. So at my previous school, we had used Cano for a wheel type of class where the students went in and built the machine and then engaged in the activities. And because it was such a great way to just make the computer and then be exposed to broad concepts within the computer science diagram, we had my students working with Linux and Python and JavaScript and CoffeeScript, and it was just a really great, so well thought out and a great piece of equipment that I brought it to Pinecrest, where now it's become part of the middle school curriculum. I teach a wheel class, so I have a group of middle school students, a different group four times a year. And what we do is we go through the entire Cano process of the build and then work through these introductory concepts for the students. Oftentimes, when we think of computer science, we sort of, well, think of quite a few things. But for me, I want the students just to be aware of some of the possibilities. So as I said, we go through the Linux commands. We do a little bit of coding in CoffeeScript, which gives them the basis for JavaScript. We get to talk about components of the machine itself and then just really explore the possibilities and have such a great time.
What I'm imagining is that, you know, perhaps previously where the process might have been a bit more stilted in terms of, okay, let's all type in the code and that kind of thing, this is actually giving a visual representation of what that affects. And I don't know if in your experience, it sounds like you have been an enthusiast individually as well. What do you see in terms of people working together now that they've got a Kano kit? So what are the kind of collaborative parts of it as well?
Well, the build process is always collaborative, where the students are working together to create this device. And what I found is that a pair of students working together on not only the build, but also on the programs and on the activities, also allows for that integration. Oftentimes, even myself included, when we thought of the traditional computer science person, mm-hmm. is just somebody in front of a keyboard. The human element wasn't part of it, but I think I know and have experience with a product like Kano and using it in my classroom, it really makes the human element the absolute most important part of the computer science process, but it also makes it, it manifests itself, not just to say, well, humans have to type code, but this is really kids working together for an experience.
And if I understand correctly, you've worked within EdTech or understanding technology and education for 19 years?
Yeah, it's been quite a while.
Not to be mean about it, but So how does Kano fit in with the sort of long tail of what you've seen previously? And you've probably seen each iteration and each wave of new products coming through. So I was just interested to know how your excitement ranked and, you know, thinking back across those years.
It's so great. I've been able to go from a legacy user, because many people my age, that's what we grew up with, the beige machines and the big machines. And I can even remember my high school days, punch cards and BASIC, and actually not only just typing in BASIC the language, but also taking those cassette tapes and then playing them on a cassette player. But to watch the students who at this particular point in time, many of my students anyway, are comfortable with brushed aluminum, if you know what I'm talking about. And to have the same experience as far as interconnectivity to the internet, to actually build and create and to do the same sort of computing on tools such as Kano, which is a completely different looking item to all of my students, many of them, is one of the coolest things to have happen, because it's not just flip open a laptop and everything's there. This is something that has to be a little bit more, you need more a tactile approach to it.
So sort of breaking out from the idea that coding or computing looks a certain way and actually it can be completely different.
Exactly. And, you know, computer science, it is really many things to many people. You say, I tell my friends or family I teach computer science, and they sort of give me that look, like, you know that one?
Yeah, and
here, this is what I help. Not only do I want to, you know, experience computer science and give my students tools, but I want them to begin the process not at a deficit. So if you think about something like biology, most people say, well, that's the study of life, and chemistry is the study of how things sort of work together, and then we say computer science. Computer science, you know, geology is the study of rocks, to be kind of basic, but computer science is still a science, but it's not the science of computers. And yes, you know, there's thousands of languages and all sorts of wonderful prototypes and microprocessors happening all over the place at just such a massive rate, but computer science, really simply, in order to get a new user or even an older experienced user on the same playing field, computer science really is simply just the study of logic. And that's how I approach my classes. That's how I let people into, you know, my process of learning. It's kind of like people can sit back and like, oh, okay, logic, yes and no, on and off. And then it builds from there. I mean, the logic that happens with a one and a zero and the items that are built and we see all around us are massive, and it takes an incredible amount of commitment and passion and understanding of languages. But at its core, it's really just a study of logic. So that's what, with that, you know, at hand as a tool, I can also, you know, work with and on and help my students' character building, because that's really, you know, back in the pre-K, you know, K-1 grades, computer science is, you know, really just a study of not only logic, but also a study of character, of working with your partner and making a plan or recognizing patterns or breaking things apart and putting things back together. You know, I see walking down the hallway and I see kindergarten classes in their centers, and the students are building with Legos or they're building with other some sort of blocks. And really that's what it is at a level of, you know, here's my Python script to make, you know, something say hello world. It's the same basis with the logic piece. And, you know, so with that in mind, I can go to my kindergarten teacher and say, you know, look what's happening here. Here is some computer science. Here are those algorithms. Here's a syntax building where, you know, if this piece doesn't fit, then I'm going to choose another one. And we just start with that language to broaden the scope of computer science.
I love that because, yeah, you just put it so simply, and it sort of broadens people's engagement. You know, you don't want people sort of switching off based on this like legacy idea of what computer science is. So I'm sure tons of people listening in will find that hugely useful to try and apply to within their own context and try their own persuasions and their own challenges that they're experiencing.
And, you know, for full transparency, I was an art major before all of this. And I taught graphic design at high school for 6 years, then moved into the education technology piece and, you know, then computer science. So my background is not necessarily code. And the way and how I get my students involved and engaged is really, I don't even know if this is a term yet, but it's sort of like applied computer science. You know, we use kits like Kano to understand some of the basic procedures and the basic languages and some of the key terms and foundations, so that when the students are moving up in grades and they get into high school and they want to say, you know what, maybe I can take that AP Comp Sci Principles course because I kind of understand things and I've had success with computer science rather than, oh, here's, you know, 4,000 lines of code. And certainly that's as important as what I'm doing, because people are, in fact, studying and learning and presenting computer science as language. Mm. But all working together, we can at least give the exposure. Now, is every student necessarily going to grow up and be a computer scientist or a programmer or a software engineer? No, but certainly just to have the exposure of it, I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because at the moment I've seen a couple of articles sort of kicking back against the hour of code and that kind of thing. And, you know, is it an essential skill? You know, here it's obviously compulsory to learn at primary school. But I think it does come back to that, you know, it's not necessarily applying that you will learn that whole language and you will have that deep mastery of computer science necessarily, but it will allow you to, for example, brief in a way that you understand the necessary tools that you're bringing into your company, if you're in a company, or, you know, whatever it may be, you have an understanding and you understand the context within which this area, which is going to be huge, you're not sort of on the outside looking in and wondering how to get in either.
I agree 100%. You know, and I took history in all my schooling, and English and math, and certainly there are concepts that are not necessary for my existence at this particular moment, but I have a fundamental understanding of, you know, either history or how to speak to you or how to, you know, add things together at what I need. And that's really what I believe we can do with and for the computer science movement. And something like Hour of Code, people go both ways with that sort of thing. I loved it when it came out. I still appreciate it so much. You know, can you imagine if an entire movement for, you know, the hour of history or the hour of algebra came out like that. And, you know, all of a sudden you've got people really wanting to enjoy doing that particular topic. And I have no concept in this, and I have no truth either way. I can imagine you know, people, traditional computer scientists and people who were programming and doing it such a way for so long, all of a sudden they look out and they see this hour of code thing happening, and students are like really excited to be, you know, I want to go into computer science. They probably were scratching their heads going, I don't, this is weird. But, you know, then there's also the sense of urgency that's been, the sense of urgency that in 2000 and whatever, there's going to be 40 billion jobs necessary for computer science, and we have to get our students. Well, I'm going to keep providing the foundations and the initial concepts and character and empathy and those tools that we can work with in computer science, not necessarily just the content. I don't want my computer science class to be, let's say, a class that I took when I was in school, which is just, you know, content driven, and you're going to go in there and you're going to watch the teacher on the chalkboard or listen to just chapter after chapter after chapter. I want them to be involved in the learning. I want it to be an exciting, you know, very dynamic course that can sort of like ebb and flow.
And I mean, I was thinking about what you said about sort of coming across from the arts side of things, so whether it's, or humanities certainly, so whether it's history or art, but actually there is sort of that common link of being able to use your imagination and just reimagine what's possible in all of those. So although, you know, you described the sort of logic behind computer science, what that enables you to do is create these whole different possibilities, and I suppose that's something that it can be said of the art world, for example, in terms of methods or, you know, and I think there is now a greater realization from people, whether it's using Minecraft or whether it's, you know, using code, and the kind of crossover between digital and art. And that's quite an interesting place to be, I think.
That's what a fantastic observation. And there's a lot of concepts involved that are out there now. People are talking about design thinking and engineering process and growth mindset and all these things. But as far as the design thinking process, it really is just empathy to empathy and all those things in between, which is, you know, as an artist, I want to have my feelings expressed into my work, but I also want to have someone else understand what that means and then have it work for them. And it's the same exact same process, except maybe not so painterly, with what we're doing with our children in just education, you know, beyond just computer science. But, you know, for us, we talk about, you know, having the proper plan and then, you know, prototyping and redoing it again and iterate that process and getting some feedback and going back and doing it all over again. And the time and place where all this happens just so naturally is really in the elementary school. That's what they are. Our elementary students, they're little logic machines. And to be able to introduce such concepts to the early grades is just so natural and wonderful to watch them work. Whereas, you know, as our kids get older, our students get older, you know, there's hormones and there's all sorts of other environmental pieces that come into play, but building those foundations, excuse me, you know, nice and early really helps us move forward.
Interesting. And in terms of Kano as well, so I know that they've got their sort of new range of kits coming out. So will you be engaging with any of those? And I'm just quite interested to know about the particular projects that you've done as well.
The Kano itself that's come into the classroom utilized the programs inside as far as the applications held within, but I am so very excited to take these new tools from Kano, the light and the pixel and the camera, and then actually utilize that for classroom use, and not only just integrate curriculum with the computer science part of it, but perhaps even bring a Kano into a classroom and have that be used as either a counter or even when we have the cameras, have the English teacher take pictures of a diagram sentence. You know, the opportunities are so limitless because of the way that we structure our computer science, which is, like I said, the study of logic. So I can take one of these new features from Kano and just put that piece inside of a classroom and let the classroom decide on how it's going to work. It's just going to be so amazing.
And then that becomes interesting because you can like play on the competitive element, I'm guessing. So rather than it being like, you know, here's this project, this is what we're going to do, it's like, you know, who's got the best idea and, you know, let's vote for that, right, and let's do that.
And that's really, you know, that's real world application. Even when we're working on online activities or even just working through something in Kano Kid called Story Mode, that is sort of the way that the interface is introduced is sort of like a retro Secret of Mana Link Zelda game from the SNES days. And the students can go in and actually interact with characters on screen. And I create that as an actual adventure, so the students have to find the questions by talking to the characters. And then the other part of it, the real world part, is that, you know, I'm, let's say, Google, and I've got a $3 billion bid for your company if you come up with the program before someone else. So the students are then engaged in, you know, semi-quasi real world activities where they have to actually do and build before someone else does and build, or be that first one.
Get in front of that investor before your
friends. Yes, and have just as much excitement as I would expect from my students, you know, constantly 24/7 in front of them. So that also is a big part of what we do at Pinecrest, and what I've done for my entire career is there's these wonderful things that are out there, and there's so many of them, but without the proper engagement, without the proper bring it into the classroom, it just becomes a thing on a desk. Mm. Whereas it really is important for the teacher to be engaged. So a question like, well, how do you use, you know, blank in the classroom? Well, it's really, how does the teacher manage their curriculum and engage their students and use it productively and teach and give the kids, you know, values like empathy and character and the, you know, collaboration and all the other C's with this thing. And then, you know, if that checklist gets less and less, then maybe that thing isn't the best thing to use. We can try something else. And you can really apply that to every single piece of some of the newer stuff that's out there. It's really the teacher engagement. And of course, you know, something like Kano for me can, you know, check off all those boxes.
So that's a really great, again, another great thing for people listening in. So just in terms of when you're faced with, you know, you might have a bit of budget and then you're just faced with this absolutely enormous potential list of things to purchase with it. So actually going from the point of view of, you know, what's that list look like that you want to tick off and making sure that it's, you know, you're getting the biggest bang for your buck in terms of those things. And, you know, if it does one thing really well, but, you know, is that enough? So
yep.
good tip. One thing I was really interested in is you mentioned that, you know, at your school you have that kind of culture of, you know, applying technology and innovation across all different sort of classrooms, so not just limiting that to computer science or whoever's leading on EdTech. So for you, where did that, I suppose, top level support of immersive innovation across the whole school come from? Because, you know, I've been in workshops with teachers and EdTech startups and that kind of thing where you can almost feel the resentment that, you know, yes, you've got all this stuff, but we just don't have time. And then when I mentioned a school where it was absolutely in their culture and in the leadership and an expectation that innovation and thinking about tech when it works to use it was, you know, expected. So I'm just interested to know, you know, how you think that came about.
Well, for Pinecrest itself, that came directly from our president, and Dana Markham's very incredibly forward-thinking individual. And we have staff and faculty that are also just as forward-thinking. So I was just lucky to be a part of such an amazing innovation process that, in fact, my first year there last year was the first year that was offered computer science and the iLabs and makerspaces pre-K to 12. That being said, I don't think I could tell you the number of times I've been asked that question, or we, if there's a collective of us, have been asked that question that can be, you know, about teacher buy-in. And I've changed my answer a couple of times. And so what I really say is, you know, teachers are strange. We are a crazy bunch of people. And I myself personally take my teachers as students. So the engagement that I give every single day in my classroom to my students is the same level of engagement and excitement that I give to my staff and my teachers. If the question can also be redone like this: well, what do you do about the student who's not engaged? Well, I've got an IEP, I've got, you know, an advocacy program, I've got differentiated instruction, I've got seating changes, I've got all of these tools that we have for our students to keep them engaged. And yet, I guess as adults, we're just sort of told what to do and expected, and we're given that sort of freedom of autonomy, or just adulthood, I guess, to say, you know what, I'm not really that interested. But we don't give that freedom to our students. It's an interesting, sometimes quite difficult maneuver to get teachers to buy in. And the very first thing that I do, like I said, is to just be that engaged and that excited for their learning also. That being said, to engage some of the more, I don't know what the word I want to use, the more one of those teachers are, is really by starting like we do with our students, is we talk to them at their level. So if there's a teacher in, regardless of what subject it is, I want to find out what they want to give their students.
Yep.
And then make the importance of whatever that piece of tech is, make what they want the most important part of it. It's not like here, this is this thing that you can do something with, but here, I see where you're working on Paul Revere. What do you think about these three things adding to this, you know, already awesome lecture or unit? So really, to give as much as I want to give ownership to my students, I want to give ownership to my faculty, to my teachers, because that's going to be, I think, the divider between those who like say no thank you, and those who would say, well, maybe I can try this, because I don't want them to feel as if I'm overstepping.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't know what you know. I know some things that can engage a learner, and I can be quite honest with my teachers and say that, you know, this is not going to enhance your lesson at all, but what it might be a good tool for is maybe a reflection piece, because as you know, reflection is one of the biggest and last piece of keeping something within our understanding, is to be able to reflect upon it. So to use, let's say, Minecraft, as we did for a fifth grade unit on the Revolutionary War, where the students built a specific item or a specific artifact, is it going to, and this is the conversation I have with the teachers, is it going to increase their understanding of, let's say again, Paul Revere's ride? Will they know more because of this? And I think the initial answer is probably not, unless they do some research and they want to find out, you know, exactly what the street looks like, because you couldn't cover it, and then they're off on their own doing some added research. But as far as the learner that you've created, this particular piece of tech is going to be, you know, a reflection piece, and maybe they'll hold on to what they know from your class a bit longer because they'll remember this piece, but it is in no way going to compromise is what you give them. And then of course we have the ability at Pinecrest to, you know, be the ones who's actually working with the students and then sort of be in the classroom and then let the teacher be with us. When I was working in the lower school, we pushed into our classes. So the teachers were able to stay with us, understand some of the concepts, and then, in fact, continue it if they chose to on their own.
So that is interesting. So in terms of retention, it becomes about, you know, providing a bit of context and making that memorable. So it was delivered in a slightly different way to, say, the past four lessons. Therefore, you remember the context you're in and perhaps retain some of the content.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, before we started recording, you mentioned this is the first podcast you've spoken on. But I saw on your Twitter feed that you speak at events and that kind of thing. So what are some of the types of things you speak about there?
I have done booth work at some of the conferences here, ISTE and FETC. I have spoken about applications to use for the youngers. 2 years ago at ISTE, I was an Ignite speaker and actually started off the conference, which was one of the most incredible 5 minutes of my life that I don't remember. And I talk too fast, and I realize that my voice, when I get nervous, is above my head, and I'm always looking to reach it. But the most interesting piece about the podcast, which I'll get to in a bit. So I appreciate your question. Most recently, I was at iPad Palooza and spoke with a colleague of mine about iPads and application use in the lower school. So I have actually been in front of a number of people, but one-to-one in a situation like this, I haven't. And interestingly enough, personally for me, when I tell people when they are nervous, I tell them to pretend you're wearing an outfit of mirrors, so that when people are actually talking to you, they're really just talking at themselves. And they sort of chuckle, and I say, well, try it. Have someone who's talking to you just hold up a mirror in front of you and let them say the same thing to you in front of this mirror. And I guarantee that it might change a little bit. So with this podcast, it's, in fact, I'm now practicing what I preach, I guess. And it's it's good because if I make a mistake and I wince, I can't be seen.
Well, there's multiple benefits, and also there's obviously the post recording edit can do wonders.
Yes.
As well.
That's that, and you have that in the background because the things that have been recorded. But the very last thing that I did was an EduPassion pitch this past October. And what my concept was, which is some of the things I pointed out here, which is, coding with character, and how do we build character for our youngest coders, and what does that look like, and how do we get the mindset and the proper tools, just the human tools to have kids and students, be able to take on algorithms or working together or collaboration and prototyping. And really, it starts with language, and it starts with some of their own language and just sort of changing it a little bit.
Yeah. So the resilience factor as well, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. So you take something as simple as it doesn't work. And we hear that so often, especially in computer science, and maybe even I don't know if this is the very first time I thought about this specific thing, so bear with me. But in a math class, when a student is working on the equation and the answer isn't coming out correctly, I don't know if a student raises their hand and says, Mr. or Ms. So-and-so, it doesn't work. Maybe they do, but certainly with what I'm giving my students as an experience, it doesn't work is one of the main comments. Whether it's Arduino or the Kano pieces or any of it, it doesn't work. And what that really does is it just takes the responsibility away from them.
Yeah.
What I've learned to do and what I have my students do is rather than say it doesn't work, I have them say the outcome is not what I intended. Because what that one simple sentence switches the responsibility directly back on them, because then I can ask them, well, what was your intention? Well, I wanted to make the light blink, or I wanted this code to work, or I wanted the color to be red circle. Well, how did that not happen? And so a conversation can be started effortlessly with their own work and their own outcome, rather than just blame.
Just dismissing it, yeah. So it's like an ICT evangelist's, I guess, version of that is it doesn't work yet. So just never letting them quite get away with it.
And I've been with the ICT evangelists and seen their Twitter feed for quite some time.
Just thinking about Twitter or whether you listen to other podcasts or recommend any other resources, are there any kind of shout outs that you'd like to make that we'll keep in here? So, for example, we have a like the EdTech podcast reading list where I've been asking people for their top three influential reads, and that can be anything on education, leadership, or fiction, but something that's had an impact on them.
The book that had the biggest impact on how I do what I do was Seymour Papert's The Children's Machine. I've read and reread that I don't know how many times. But I do have a list for you that I can give you for the post edit and maybe post a Google Short or a Bitly. I have a whole library of books that I've purchased for my youngest coders, one of which is coming out now on Sprout, which is a children's channel here from Randy Zuckerberg. It's called Dot.
I've heard about this.
It's really, it's such a super book. Oh my goodness. it's going to be a television series as well. I also have Ada Lovelace superstar book. There's RoboSauce. There's so many really great books that allow our youngest to just hear the terms and see the words. Of course, Hello Ruby is just beautiful. And then one of a really cool sort of Alice in Wonderland, Harry Potter, Clive Barker, Aberrat sort of book is called Lauren Ipsum. And this is a girl, Lauren Ipsum, who goes into computer science land and meets, you know, friends like Jargon and Not. It's just a super, super book.
That sounds amazing. A couple of episodes ago, I was interviewing a Finnish startup who are launching a game where all the characters are different periodic table particles
elements.
And they go off and have different adventures and whether it's helium or whatever it is. But yeah, so that's, I guess, a similar idea, but really cool. So animating and sort of bringing those different, what previously probably have had a bit of a rough deal in terms of making them exciting.
But how great is that, though, to be a child coming up and just being able to have these experiences in learning that are just so progressive so absolutely foundational, but really, really fun, and not just having to do the same old, classroom routine. It's just so great. But again, it really is up to us to even work harder as educators, because, you know, there are so many things out there that we can just say, here, go try this, but we really need to engage with them, and that's what's going to make all the difference.
Yeah. And then in terms of Kano as well, so I guess everyone, certainly those people that, life is incredibly busy, and especially if you're educators, there's always probably that feeling of, oh, if only I had more time, I would do X, Y, Z. So I just wondered what is on your kind of to-do list coming up in the next couple of months.
Oh, my goodness.
Not to put any pressure on.
No pressure. No pressure at all. I don't have anything on my short-term to-do list other than happy family, healthy family, and same thing for my students.
Yeah.
There is, though, some news of what Google has done with their hardware and the Daydream and the Pixel camera. So that might be on my sort of to-do list. But certainly getting those three new packs from Kano and seeing how they can implement in classroom. I know how I can work with them. I mean, I've been working with them for years, but it's really going to be sort of like a gateway into getting these kits and this system of build into an art class or into a science class or into the English class, because the actual tools that they're building are functional and can be utilized across the board. Whereas the Kano itself, the it's not as obvious maybe to an English teacher or math teacher on what I can do with this, but bringing them a camera or bringing them an LED shield that can showcase today's assignment or even just the values that are necessary or some of the symbols for math or science or all of it, that's more of a tangible, oh, okay, I could use this. And then how awesome would it be to have one of my students or students who have been in my class set the device up for the teacher, and then they become that expert in the classroom for that specific device, and then they can be the reason why someone knows something. It's going to be a great
that's
year.
Quite cool, and that's quite a badge of honor for that student, isn't it, as well?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. And then all the disruption recently, when will you your family will be all back together?
They're going to come back Tuesday. We have schools closed for a couple of days for a holiday next week. So we'll all be back together Tuesday evening.
Okay, well, that is good. And that's something to look forward to. So I think for the moment, that's probably everything. So I just wanted to say thank you very much for your time. And of course, we'll let you know when this is all out. But just quickly before we go, how can people also follow you and find out about what you're doing?
Oh, I don't know if I've ever said this before. But yes, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @CriticalClick. I'd love to hear from you and with you and share with you. engage with your students and just be passionate with whatever it is that you do.
That's a good message to finish on. Well, Michael, thank you very much. And no doubt we'll speak again soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye now.